Okay, I'm going to call the June 15th, 2020 meeting of the Government Operations Committee to order. The legislative assistant has noted that we do have a quorum. This is a special session, and this meeting is being conducted pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I think it is, allowing for remote debate. So we have a couple bills here. There are no minutes to be approved. These are part of our public safety reform package. There are two bills that we will be considering, House File 73 and House File 75. Those are clones of House File 2 and 3. And then there are a couple amendments that will be considered that will incorporate provisions from other bills. We have the bill authors here. Only some provisions of these bills are germane to the Government Operations Committee. So we are under a bit of a time crunch here. So I'm going to be a little more aggressive in forcing just trying to focus the conversation to provisions that are within the jurisdiction of the Government Operations Committee. We're going to mix up the order of the two bills a little bit just because we have a testifier here. So the first bill on the agenda is House File 75, Chair Mariani's bill, the Reimagining Public Safety Act. I will move House File 75 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Chair Mariani, did you want to do a short presentation? My understanding is there's only one provision here that is germane to the Government Operations Committee, and then we will be considering an amendment, the Restore the Vote amendment. Did you want to give a brief overview, Chair Mariani? I think the only provision that's germane to GovOps is the establishing the Office of Community-Led Public Safety Coordination.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, thank you, and I will be super brief. Public Safety Committee will be moving out shortly will be 3 acts, and we have two of them before us. Today, there are a number of provisions within these acts that are meant to interact with one another, strengthen one another, and primarily for the purpose of enhancing accountability in our system that involves the interaction between local and state government in order to build a better public safety system, one that doesn't produce the all too familiar tragic outcomes of black men, in particular black men and women, dying at the hands of our licensed and locally regulated peace officers. I think with that, I'll just keep it very brief to that. There's lots that I do want to say, but perhaps that can come out during the course of our conversation. The community-led public safety concept is about maturing and filling out our approach to public safety. In our public safety committee, we've spent nearly 2 years centered on the powerful notion that crime often is the manifestation of problems in a community. The problems are multiple. Unfortunately, we primarily heavily depend on our licensed peace officers to resolve all those problems. They're the ones who get called for domestics, for mental health episodes, for misunderstandings among neighbors that sometimes often escalate. The thinking, vision really is to create out a set of tools so that our armed police officers aren't the only ones who are attempting to solve community problems. So the community-led policing is a way for us to focus on how do we grow that out. It involves investments within the state through local government, identifying and partnering with community groups, with organizations that precisely are set up to do the important translation, which is so critical in our society, which is a multiracial society with a legacy of racism and quite frankly, legacy of oppression, therefore. And so so the idea with the community lip policing is to expand out, fill in a way to create those extra public tools to solve community problems. With that, I'll stop. You have a couple of members who have worked on your committee on this particular issue, particularly Chair Dean, who may be able to speak more to the concept as well. But at this point, Mr. Chair, in honoring your time constraints, I'll stop and stay up for questions.
Sure. I think we might move to the amendments first, and then there's just one amendment. But actually, before doing that, Mr. Gehring, could you actually just confirm establishing the Office of Community-Led Public Safety Coordination is the primary provision within this bill for the Government Operations Committee?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That's because you're creating a new office that will be normally within the scope of the committee's jurisdiction.
Okay, thank you. So I'd like to just take up the amendment because I have a feeling we might spend more time on that. So since Chair Mariani's not on the committee, I will move the, things are moving around on my, what's,
The A1, Chair.
What, I beg your pardon?
The A1.
It's the A1 amendment. Thank you. So I will move the A1 amendment. This is the Restore the Vote amendment. Chair Mariani, would you like to discuss the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I can do very quickly. There also might be other individuals in the committee, but let me get to my notes here. So Restore the Vote. Give me a sec. So this bill will require the Secretary of State's office to prepare informational publication on voting rights for individuals who have been convicted of a crime, and require each state and local correctional facility to designate an official to give notice to those individuals whose rights have been restored along with voter registration application. It also updates the certification signed by voters in polling places attesting to their eligibility to vote to elect the restoration of the civil right provided by the bill. Minnesota is one of 22 states where felons cannot vote until they've completed post-incarceration supervision, such as probation and parole. This provision would restore that right upon the completion of the period of incarceration. This entire package was put together by members of the caucus of people of color and indigenous that exists in our house. And for them and for us, I'm a member as well. What they propose here, one, is a bill that this body has passed. I believe it also enjoyed bipartisan support. But unfortunately, it has not been able to be finalized. And two, that the issue of individuals so empowered in order to make decisions about local governance, including the regulation of local law enforcement, is critically important in this time and age, precisely because of the huge disproportionate number of people of color and indigenous people in our incarceration system. So, Mr. Chair, that's a very quick walkthrough and explanation of both the purpose and what the bill does.
Thank you. Chair Dean, I noticed you raised your hand. We also have Secretary Simon here to testify on this. Did you want to comment now or after the testimony, Chair Dean?
I can just speak briefly. Restore the Vote is something that's been in the legislature, I think, going back to 2002. It's something that has, over time, garnered bipartisan support. And I just want to remind folks that this isn't some crazy left-wing conspiracy. We have states like Indiana, North Dakota, Utah and Montana, and I don't think anybody would call them left-leaning states. This is the right thing to do. It's always the right time to do the right thing to do, and I hope that members will continue to support this particular provision, which is now being incorporated into House File 75.
Thank you, Chair Dean. Secretary Simon, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. Can you hear me okay? I was having a little trouble with some scrambled audio at some point, but maybe it's just me. Okay. Thank you very much. Members, you're familiar with this bill. You're familiar with this idea. From where I sit, if we have learned anything, one damn thing from the last 3 weeks, anything, it's that we need unity, we need reconciliation, we need compassion, we need a rethinking about how we approach some of these issues. That's it. It's not going away. It's not going to simmer down. That's it. This is new. It doesn't just feel different. It is different. And so the idea with this bill is really to invest in our democracy. Because I'll tell you what, if we don't do that, people are going to give up on America. I'm telling you right now, they will give up on America. If we continue to treat people as outcasts, even when they're not cast out, when they go to prison, they understand. It's part of the social contract. When they go to prison, they understand they are cast out. They don't get the same rights and privileges as all the rest of us. They've done wrong. Either a jury of their peers or a judge or someone has determined they are literally behind bars. When they walk out of prison, they have done their time. Can you hear me?
Yes. Now I think it's better now.
Okay. When they get out of prison, when they have done their time, they should have the expectation that their civil rights are restored, and especially their right to vote. If we don't do that, if we continue not to do that, if we continue to have somewhere between 50 and 60,000 Minnesotans who are cast out, even though they're not physically cast out as they maybe once were, or Minnesotans who have never done a day of prison or jail because the prison part has been suspended, and we tell them they can't have a say in who governs them and how, or how their families are governed, then we're going to have to reckon with that. Then we just have to accept those consequences. And I don't know that that's something that members of this committee want to do. So you've heard a lot of the arguments before. You've heard that we have over 50,000 people. You've heard that all the studies show that making sure that people who have been in prison, who are out of prison, bringing them back into the fold of democracy actually encourages their children. It has a direct effect on their children, on their own sense of purpose, on their own trajectory in life. They don't feel like outcasts anymore. They are invested in America. They are invested in Minnesota. And that's something that we should all want to encourage. And from an administrative standpoint, I can tell you, as the chief elections administrator, it's far, far easier to administer, in case you care about that. Far, far easier to administer than the system now where, tragically, people fall through the cracks. Tragically, there are people who mistakenly believe that they had the right to vote back. They didn't get the memo. They didn't get the message. And tragically, go and commit another felony because they don't understand the rules. And then you have people who misunderstand the other way. People who believe falsely that they can't vote and have believed for years or decades that they can't vote when they can. An ease of administration, a bright line rule like this one. If you're in prison, you can't vote. If you step out of prison because someone, somewhere, a judge, someone has determined that you're safe enough and worthy enough to rejoin the rest of us, then you can vote. Easy to administer as well. I don't need to tell you, some of you heard the historical arguments. When Minnesota became a state, there were a few dozen felonies. Now there are hundreds and hundreds of felonies. The dragnet is so much wider than it was 150-odd years ago. And so, members, in light of the events of the last 3 weeks, but not only, this is not, you know, certainly only, there's not one dimension to this issue. It's not just a racial issue. This is an everybody issue. This is rural. This is white. This is people of color. This is metro. This is all over Minnesota. So we owe it to everybody to make sure that the welcome mat is out for those who have done their time and that they can rejoin society by rejoining democracy. Thank you for your time and attention. I hope you consider supporting the bill. Amendment.
Thank you for your testimony, Secretary Simon. That's the only testifier who signed up. So we'll go to member questions on the amendment. Ranking Member Quam, you were first.
Well, first I'd like to correct one early part of where the Secretary of State referenced the bill being such and such. And then at the end, he did state that he was talking about the amendment. The bill, and an apartment thing about the bill, is it's meant to improve the system, correct errors with the law enforcement, police procedures, community involvement, etc. That is what the bill is for and about. Now, it was also brought up earlier that this has been, for the amendment now, has been a topic of discussion for over a decade. And I am just very confused why you would take a bill. And I've looked at it, and there are some good things in it. And I have high hopes that we will have good things in the final passed signed legislation. Why would you muddy that with something that some of us, and obviously since it's not in law, enough of us legislators think has a flaw? And how I see the flaw is this: it's discriminatory. Because if you are rich, connected, powerful, etc., you have a great lawyer, you have a higher probability of getting non-incarceration or having much smaller incarceration time and the rest being probation or home release, etc. But if you're poor and not privileged, not connected, you spend your time in prison. If you want to address something in regards to voting rights, then address that. And I think there's been discussions on it. But make it fair, because I don't think anyone is silly enough to think that if you can't have, you know, equality in voting, you should not add something in the amendment. My thought is, I know a lot of lawyers, and I know there's a difference between lawyers, and a lot of the lawyers that make, you know, lots of money per hour are very good at their job, and they are hired and in demand because they can get you less time in jail or get you home release or get you probation. And it's silly to think that if you grant additional powers and privileges to the ones that are fortunate enough to have the money, the connections, etc., to not have to serve the prison time or serve a shorter time in prison and the rest probation. And so, obviously, this bill needs to have strong support and interaction. And please do not dilute it by adding a corollary of this amendment that isn't direct to the point of addressing police policies, procedures, and the rights of citizens. So I guess if this goes on, I don't even know if I can vote for the bill. I don't have a problem with voting for the bill without the amendment. So it's up to you, the rest of the members of this committee, to decide what is important. Is the core behind the bill important? Or we're going to go ahead and use this as a vehicle to pass something that hasn't passed in almost two decades from what previous person mentioned. So I think I made myself clear.
Sure. Thank you, Ranking Member Quam. Chair Mariani, would you, I mean, like to just talk briefly about what you see as the connection between the amendments and the underlying bill, since you are the author of the underlying bill?
Yes, indeed, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'll try to be very brief. And let me just start off with a positive reaction to Representative Quam's endorsement of lots of good provisions in this bill. I would argue this actually is one of those very good provisions. And I understand the argument to an extent. Let me just say that I don't think it's at all unusual for us to understand that we have interconnecting policies and realities, whether we're talking about agriculture, roads, education. Our job is to see the connections and to pass policies that reinforce one another across those connections. So environmental water quality issues and helping farmers are totally mutually beneficial, and we wind up passing legislation to that extent. On this point, and I, as I said earlier, the nexus, quite frankly, is that when you look at the result of our current law enforcement, you know, who gets stopped, who gets arrested, who therefore often winds up on the wrong end of use of force by our licensed officers. When you look at our correction system, who's serving in our local jails, in our prisons, the numbers just pop out and make your eyes bulge. We're a state with a relatively small community of indigenous people and people of color, but you wouldn't know that if you were to look at those police stops. You wouldn't know that if you were to look at you know, our correction system. And so that's the context within which we make these connections between all these good provisions about better policing, as well as, on this point, as well as the ability of individuals, especially, particularly those who have served their commitment for having been convicted of a wrongdoing, to be able to bring them back into the fold so they can be part of electing those who regulate the behavior of our local law enforcement, who regulate our correction system and our judiciary system. That's what we mean by re-enfranchising individuals. And so then the proposal is that precisely because these communities are the most heavily disproportionately harmed by our collective decisions on regulating law enforcement and corrections, that once having met their obligation, their duty to society, they should then also be part of making that decision. As people of color, as indigenous people, they would have powerful experiences and a personal stake in making sure that our, for instance, our local police conform and act themselves in a way that respect the human rights of all people, including people of color. So that's the connection. I understand the legitimate, you know, question about how much do you put into a package? You know, where do you draw the lines? I think this is an appropriate connection. It's about empowering people, all citizens in Minnesota, so that we can get better informed decisions from our elected officials that they elect, who have this awesome duty to regulate our law enforcement, judiciary, and correction system.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I neglected to mention at the outset that members of the subcommittees on local government and elections have also been invited to participate in this discussion, just because some of these issues touch on those issues as well. And the next person, appropriately enough, is Chair of the Local Government Subcommittee, Chair Mason. You were next on the list. If you could unmute yourself, please. It looks like you are still muted. Ms. Rudolph, are you able to unmute Chair Mason?
Okay, that did it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And either the secretary or Chair Mariani can answer it. If I recall, there are some states that do not take away the voting rights. Is that still the case?
Secretary Simon, I think you might be the appropriate person for this question.
Yes, I'm sorry. There was a little audio problem on my end. You're asking, are there any states that do this, that do what this bill does?
Basically. No, the question is, are there states that never take away the right to vote?
Oh, ever. Yes, there are two. Maine and Vermont are the only two states in the country where you never lose it. You could be in prison, and you could be in prison for life, and you never lose your right to vote. This is not that, obviously. But, yes, there are two states that do that.
Okay, thank you. My question is, why is taking away the right to vote part of the punishment? I understand the incarceration. That's punishment. But the fact that we don't deport these people, they're still in our country, they're still in our state, does it truly make sense to take away their rights as a citizen?
Kind of a policy question, and we're obviously arguing to do the opposite with this amendment, but Secretary Simon, I don't know if you have any knowledge about the historical context of why this was implemented in the first place.
Yeah, no. Mr. Chair, if I may, and Representative Mason, thanks for the question. Yeah, I leave to others to talk about the history. All I know is that this amendment, and hopefully this bill, will be a step in the direction of making sure that at the very least, when people leave prison, when they've done their time, they are no longer outcasts, the outcasts that they are in prison. They aren't cast out anymore, and they shouldn't be made to feel that way. Otherwise, we're going to get predictable results. If you treat someone like an outcast and they're no longer cast out physically, let's not be surprised if people are disillusioned or disgusted.
Yep. Chair Dean, did you have a comment on this? And let's see. I'm not hearing you. I'm still not hearing you.
Yeah. I have to plug in my headphones. I forget that occasionally.
Sure.
You know, I think that in the context of this, when an individual was convicted of felony and sent to prison historically, there were a couple key components of their civil rights that were lost. One was, of course, voting, and the other one is the right to carry a gun. You know, currently the only way that you get your ability to carry a gun back is you have to go through the courts or receive a pardon for your offense that you committed. Whereas voting currently, once you're off supervision, and Secretary Simon did a great job of outlining that there are many individuals that, you know, never step foot inside one of our state facilities that are losing their right to vote for what could be actually a generation. I mean, literally, there are individuals who have been convicted with long sentences of probation that have children. Those children grow up, and they never get to vote for who's on the school board, for instance. So, you know, there are a lot of things around this. You know, there are, I believe, 18 states and one other jurisdiction that allow individuals to vote once they are out of being incarcerated in a state facility. So, and I mentioned a few of the other states. So this is not outside the norm, but, you know, the thought was if you did something in violation with, you know, what was considered a law or, you know, a community norm, that you would then lose those rights. And we've seen that losing those rights aren't a key component in your future behavior. As a matter of fact, we know that when individuals get their right to vote restored, they're more vested in their community and are more civically engaged. So there are a lot of reasons why this was put in place. I wasn't around back in the mid 1800s, But I'm guessing that part of it was punitive. And we know that, you know, we have a system that's supposed to be rehabilitative, not punitive. So this falls along the line, I believe, of a system that's rehabilitative and tries to set individuals up for success rather than sets individuals up for failure.
Okay. Thank you.
Very quickly.
I'd like to get moving pretty quickly. We still have another bill with several amendments, and I have three members on the list. But Chair Mariani, yes, if you could be brief here.
Mr. Chair, I will be very brief. If you study Jim Crow era and the legal construct of Jim Crow, then this provision becomes very obvious. Jim Crow was an era that found all sorts of ways to use the legal process to disenfranchise and harm and kill Black folks. That was then reinforced by disenfranchising them from voting. And one of the ways that that happened was precisely, it's like a cycle, precisely putting people in jail, taking away their rights. Now they have no ability to regulate the misuse of that legal system that created all sorts of bizarre punishments, quite frankly, for just simply being Black. So Jim Crow is a good lesson for us to understand the nexus of this issue before us.
Okay, thank you, Chair Mariani. Chair Mason, does that conclude your questioning?
Since we don't have time, my ultimate reason for asking the question is, does it make sense at all to take away their right to vote? Mm-hmm. We're incarcerating them. That's a huge punishment.
Sure.
So, and that's just a comment I'm making and wondering if it was too much of a stretch to do just totally change that procedure.
Thank you, Chair Mason. I should mention, too, we have discussed this in the past. This was part of the election omnibus last year. So with that, Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author of the amendment, is this change irrespective of probation? So is the probation period not factored into the ability to a person to get back to voting?
Mr. Freiberg, I probably defer to Chair Dean, who is the major architect of this bill. But the point is that once you're out of, physically step out of a prison, then the clock starts in terms of the restoration of your rights. That does not mean that you don't fulfill any supervised supervision or probation that was also part of your sentence.
Chair Dean, any follow-up?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash. As the bill is written, it will allow an individual who is on probation the ability to vote. But as Chair Mariani mentioned, oftentimes when an individual is on probation, there are a number of other conditions that are applied to that individual and their conditions of probation. And this would only affect the issue around voting. It wouldn't affect any of the other conditions on an individual's probation.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, okay. So I will freely admit that we need probation reform here in the state of Minnesota. We've got some very long probation times. But if probation ostensibly is part of the rehabilitation process, I do have some difficulties in just as you walk out the door of a prison, having your vote immediately restored. And both Chair Dean and Chair Mariani know where I am on this. We've talked about it in the past. But I just think that we're missing a component to the rehabilitation process because there is some recidivism. And I think that that is something that we should work on, the recidivism rate. And we should work on addressing the probationary periods. But I am not one of the ones that is in the bipartisan camp on this, so I'll be voting no. But I just wanted to clarify that this does not factor in any consideration of the probationary period relative to the restoration of the vote. So for that reason, I'll be voting no. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative McDonald.
Yeah, just a quick question to remind me of current law, Secretary Simon and or Representative Maroney on your amendment. Should someone not be sentenced to prison time, but probation only, will your amendment or current law allow that person to be able to vote while on that probation instead of jail time?
Who would like to handle this one? Chair Mariani?
Mr. Chair, I'll take a stab. I may need to call a legal counsel to make sure that I'm correct about this. But this applies to those who are incarcerated. And so it's the release from incarceration that then leads to the immediate restoration of voter rights.
Okay. Thank you. Representative McDonald, any follow-up?
No, I guess that's fine. I mean, I believe that we are a nation that believes in rehabilitation and, reforms. If someone does their time in prison and they've been released, they're back into our society. And I think we ought to give them the trust that they've earned, hopefully, once they've served their time. But and I have supported this in the past as well, as Restore the Vote, and have gone thought about it in different views, listened to a lot of my constituents. So I'm open to it, but I think it's I believe with Representative Quam that this should be a standalone bill, or at least not attached to this bill, because it will create obviously some controversy and some issues that members won't be able to support it. So I wish that it was two different votes, two different bills, and not attached to this one that has some great reform. So with that, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you for allowing me to opine on this. This is an issue that I have supported for quite a long time, and a number of years, with Representative Dean. And let's be clear about the founding principles of our state constitution. In 1858, there was no such thing as probation. It was strictly tied to incarceration. And as Secretary Simon has pointed out, we have more than 400 plus felony convictions on the statute books at this time. I have always supported the notion and the idea that, and it is clear that the state of Minnesota and the legislature determines these things. This is not a constitutional issue about having to connect probation to the sentence in terms of fulfilling that. The state legislature has the authority to amend when people get to vote. Clearly, if you're incarcerated as a felon, it makes a bright line and makes it easy for our election judges to know that if you're standing in line, you're eligible to vote. The voter ID issue is another thing which I wish were attached to this as an amendment, because then I think we could have full bipartisan support in a time of compromise to really ensure integrity to our voting system. So with that, it's pretty clear that we have the ability to amend this. This is not a constitutional issue in terms of violating the state constitution. The legislature determines what the penalties are. And I'll also mention that, a lot of people, oftentimes, the earlier comment was mentioned about having good representation and equity in terms of the law. Oftentimes you can get felony convictions with good representation, plea bargain down to a gross misdemeanor. And in that situation, then you still get to vote. So it's long overdue. And I think I'd just like to mention that I was asked to go to Washington and testify before a Senate subcommittee on this issue. I traveled there and I supported it. And I was asked by people in the Senate, in the U.S. Congress, how we can get this to pass. And again, I mentioned the support voter ID, and I think it'd be bipartisan all across the nation. We have some states in the nation that you never lose your right to vote, even if you're an incarcerated felon. you still get to vote in prison. And then as Representative Dean has mentioned, we have a number of states that tie it to when you're out of incarceration, you get to vote. And then we also have some states, regardless of what the penalty is, you never, ever get to vote again, even after probation. Once you've been a felon, you lose your right to vote forever. And I have always maintained that if you're not inimical to public safety, you're not a threat to being out in the public, how is it that you're a threat to vote? It just doesn't make any sense. And if you want to enfranchise people and create stable communities, I believe that it's important to participate in school board elections and local elections, as well as federal and state elections. And what we really have by a patchwork of 50 states, we have no continuity with regard to federal elections because of the state laws. And under a number of constitutional provisions in our U.S. Constitution, I believe the federal government has the authority, or Congress does, to create uniformity across 50 states with regard to federal elections. And if that should happen, then we'll be having a dual system of elections where you'll have to have one set of elections for federal elections and another set for state elections. So by default, Congress could clean this up, because I don't think too many states would want to hold two sets of elections and having some standardization as to what makes you eligible, ineligible. I realize I may be a departure from my caucus on this, but this is something I've lobbied for almost 8 years, and I support this. I will also comment that I think we should be taking this up as a separate issue, but politics is politics, and this is an opportunity that it's being attached to a bill. And it is what it is, but, you know, I would support and look for an amendment to this that also adds voter ID to it. And thank you. Those are my comments.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Hertas. Representative Quam, as the ranking member, I'll give you the last word, and then I'd like to vote on the amendment. If you're trying to talk right now, you're muted.
As you, as was discussed earlier, this has been an issue for some time. In fact, it's sort of surprising, or I should say telling, that when both chambers and the governorship were underneath the same party, that this never passed and became law. And I think there might be some issues, and I personally had talked about the, it's discriminatory or biased towards the people that can afford a good lawyer, but debating on that is separate. The core bill, does this need to be added to the core bill? And I think it makes the bill less likely to go through easily, and it's too important of an issue to not have it go through. So thank you. I think I've made it clear that this would be a bad thing for the core bill.
What?
Thank you, Representative Quam. I don't have any additional members on the list, so I will call the vote on the A1 amendment. Could all those in favor please say aye? Aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion carries. So thank you for that discussion. So is there any additional discussion to the underlying bill, House File 75? I'll give a few seconds. Okay, I'm not seeing any. So I will renew my motion that House File 75, as amended, be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. This, I believe, needs to be a roll call vote. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Salk.
Yes.
Representative Quam.
I had raised my hand before the start of the call, and I will not vote for this bill. I will not vote on this bill with the amendment added into it.
Okay, so I apologize. I see now I hadn't looked at the document that's keeping track of whose members, who has raised their hand. So I apologize, Representative Quam. I did not see that. But I guess based on what you're saying, that will mark you down as a no. And the clerk.
That is not, I stated that I would not be voting on
the bill
with the addition of this non-core issue.
Okay, understood. So, Ms. Somick, please mark Representative Quam as a pass, I guess. So, and continue with the roll.
Representative Bonner.
Yes.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Gomez.
Aye.
Representative Heinrich.
No.
Representative Tegel.
Yes.
Representative Lehman.
No.
Representative Lee.
Aye.
Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
No.
Representative Vogel.
No.
Representative West.
No.
With 10 ayes, Chair, the motion passes.
Sir, how many nays we usually say?
10 ayes and 6 nays and 1 pass.
Yes. So by vote of 10 to 6, House File 75 as amended is referred to the Ways and Means Committee. So the next bill on our agenda is House File 73. I think it might make sense actually to start. I will move House File 73 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. I think it might make sense for Mr. Gehring since there's a lot more provisions in this one, just to explain which ones are within the jurisdiction of the Government Operations Committee. And then I will turn it over to Chair Mariani just to, in case he has anything to add to that. So, Mr. Gehring.
So, Mr. Chair, as drafted in front of you, in Article 1 of House File 73, there's language that establishes or gives the option there's language related to local citizen oversight councils for law enforcement agencies. This is not creating a new state council, but it is providing a structure for these councils within local governments. So I describe this as being within the committee's mostly local government jurisdictional. There's also open meetings law questions in there. On page 15, section 12 is language that modifies the procedure for peace officer grievance arbitration procedures. So that would be kind of within the committee's general jurisdiction related to employment issues. And then sections 14 and 15, which I know there's an amendment has been posted to these sections, establish residency requirements for local peace officers in Minneapolis and St. Paul as drafted in this bill. And that also would be within the committee's local government jurisdiction.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Chair Mariani, did you have any additional commentary to those sections of the bill?
Mr. Chair, I really don't. I think in respect of time, it'd be good to just have the conversation and questions from the committee.
Okay. Thank you. So let me just make sure. Okay, nobody's raised their hands. So I think maybe it might make sense to do the amendments first, and then we can move to – then we can have discussion on the bill as it is. So I guess I will move – Amendment A3, this is related, so this is an amendment I had prepared. It relates to the provision allowing local governments to adopt residency requirements for peace officers. As the bill is drafted, it only allows the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul to do that. This amendment would expand that to all cities. Both the underlying bill and the amendment only apply to new employees hired after a certain date. I understand there would be some contract clause issues if it were to apply to existing employees. So I know there was some discussion in the Public Safety Committee hearing the other day about this, that it might be a good requirement just to give cities besides Minneapolis and St. Paul the ability to adopt these sorts of requirements. So I had an amendment prepared that would do that. So I don't know if anyone has any discussion to, so I will offer, if I haven't already, the A3 amendment. And I don't know if anyone, maybe wait a minute just to see if anyone has any comments on the amendment. And Chair Mariani, did you want to comment on it at all? I suppose it's a common practice to let the author of the bill discuss amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a good amendment. We did have a 7-hour plus hearing on Saturday where we heard from local jurisdictions, particularly the mayor of Brooklyn Center. I always mix up Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park. And Richfield, we've also heard, not in a hearing, but from other municipalities, that they want to be part of this permissive, be included within this permissive action on the part of the legislature. There's a history here. At one time, it was certainly doable, allowable, that kind of moved back and forth with the state banning that permission. It then reopened it for Minneapolis and St. Paul and then went back on that as well. So the bill starts out with a Minneapolis-St. Paul permissive structure. This is in response to requests from leaders of small municipalities from across, at least across the region, if not across the state, who have asked for the same consideration.
Okay, thank you. And I have a note here that I'm supposed to mention that for the record that Representative West has joined us. So welcome to the committee. Representative Nash, you have a question or comment to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question. You know, the comments of Representative Klum relative to the expansion of the purview of the previous bill, adding an elections issue into a policing issue. I guess I'm going to do a little bit of the same. Would this also be requisite for teachers and other things of the municipality or area that's concerning, so that a teacher who teaches in the Minneapolis school district would also have to live in Minneapolis? Because I know that we are a fairly mobile greater metropolitan area. Many people that live here in Waconia have lived here, grown up here, spent their time here, own or have inherited family houses, and yet they would like to be a Minneapolis cop or a St. Paul cop. And I just wonder if you would address this issue, because I do feel that you're limiting your pool of talented police. And I understand the need to have an interaction or a connection to the community, but I just have some reservations relative to this going on. I do get something like this for when I was mayor, a volunteer fire department. You have to live within the response time. That makes sense. But I am confused, because when a police person goes to the job, they drive from their home to the station and they're on duty. You know, I would argue that you could be as detached from your community living in the city that you police as you could from living outside of the community. So I'm just trying to figure out what's the angle here. And then is this also something that is open to amendments to say that teachers and others that live or work for the municipality should work there, reside there as well? Because again, public works, an important function for municipalities. Do you plan on requiring people who do public works to also live within the municipality. So that's my question, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Nash. I guess my response would be this does not require anybody to live anywhere. This just gives local jurisdictions the authority to impose those requirements. And I would imagine if it's a small community, you know, concerned about limiting the applicant pool, they wouldn't adopt it. So this is just basically a local control amendment.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could, you know, I have been roundly criticized by your caucus for taking up bills that you deem prescriptive to local control. I guess I would ask Mr. Gehring, does this not already exist within municipalities to set policy for whether they do or do not wish to have that requirement of their police force? Is that not something that a home rule charter city, for example, Minneapolis, St. Paul, could not already do this? So I guess that's my question.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, I would actually defer to Ms. Dyson, who I think is also on the call to respond to this.
Sure. Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, under current law, local governments cannot adopt residency requirements in the metropolitan area. I believe that outside the metropolitan area, I'm trying to make sure I have this right, but I think there's some time and response rate requirements that can be imposed. I need to pull up the statute that's being amended, but let's see. If you give me a second to find the statute. But I right now, no, they cannot impose for police. They can't in the metro area. They cannot impose residency requirements. Let me get this.
Representative Nash, I know there is a history of this, and I think Ms. James is here too and can maybe talk about this, but you know, I think this up until 1980 or so, cities and counties could adopt residency requirements. And then at some point that was changed. So there was preemption. And then at some point in the 90s, there was a session law passed that gave this authority to Minneapolis and St. Paul. And then in the late 90s, that was repealed. So now the standard is that no cities can adopt this sort of requirement.
Mr. Chair. And Representative Nash, yeah, there is the provision in the statute that's being amended. There's subdivision 3 that talks about volunteer and nonprofit firefighters that you can have a reasonable residency requirement on persons employed as volunteer or as members of nonprofit firefighting corporations if there's a demonstrated job-related necessity. And it has to be related to response time, and it's established without regard to the political subdivision boundaries. And then, let's see, I think then the other provision is that cities or counties outside of the metro area can impose reasonable area or response time residency requirements. So in the metro area, you cannot impose any kind of residency requirement.
Yeah, and I guess I would just add, if you look at the language of the amendment, it includes the default provision in Minnesota law. It just says, notwithstanding any other provision, no home rule charter, ordinance or resolution, no statutory or home rule charter city shall require that a person be a resident of the city as a condition of employment. So this would amend that just to allow people hired after a certain date. But the default position is that they can't. Is they can't adopt residency requirements, but there is the exception for like reasonable response time for firefighters that Ms. Dyson mentioned. So Representative Nash, any follow-up?
I'm good, I guess.
Okay. Any additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. So then we have, just trying to figure this out here. I believe there's an A1 amendment. This relates to the post board reform. This adds in language for the post board reform and data collection amendments. So I will move the A1 amendment. Representative Chair Mariani, would you like to describe that amendment?
Mr. Chair, yes. And we'll be super thoroughly going through this in public safety as well as in the judiciary today in the form of a clone in judiciary. The major feature of this is that this really is at the heart of the reform efforts for our state to be able to get a firm, strong hand consistent with Minnesota values related to the killings of civilians at the hands of police officers, particularly African-American men. And quite frankly, what it does is it creates a council at the core of this. It creates a council within the Pulse Board itself. The language spells out the composition of that council, how it's appointed, et cetera, and the purpose. And the purpose of the council then, along with accompanying language that judiciary will be vetting with data, is to collect public data. This is data that's already public. Collect public data from the various law enforcement entities across the state. There's well over 500 of them, in order to do strong analysis of that data, in order to then issue policy recommendations back up to the Pulse Board. Pulse Board is the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, which is our licensing board for peace officers, as well as the board that provides for training expectations of our peace officers on a regular basis. So this board will be super focused on analyzing the data around particularly use of force and discipline in order to inform the Pulse Board's decision of adjusting licensing and also of taking disciplinary actions if there are patterns that are discovered as a result of this particular group. So that really is quickly in a nutshell what it is. It creates that council within the Pulse Board itself to do that vitally important work. It really closes the loop, the gap right now that exists between this mountain of data that we have, but no effective way in which to pull that together so that we can adjust our powerful licensing. Licensing should be powerful. Expectations of our peace officers, who after all are granted special authority for the use of force with the citizenry in order to enhance, make better those practices, as well as to identify and hopefully early identify where there are patterns of bad behavior that would then allow the licensing board to step in a proactive manner. So, Mr. Chair, that basically is it in a nutshell.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. So, and I know this is also being heard. So this language would put it in conformance with the clone bill, that the bill that it's a clone to. And I know this is also getting heard in judiciary where the data issues, I'm sure, will be fully discussed as well. Is that correct?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Is there any discussion to this amendment? I don't have anybody's hand raised at this point. Representative Bonner, I see you raising your hand.
I figured that was quicker than finding the button. I will just make it brief. I think it's no surprise that I am a big fan of having good tools in the form of data. I think it's a powerful tool. As they say, knowledge is power. And specifically in this case, it gives a power to act. And we know that there are amazing police and peace officers that do truly wonderful work. And this gives tools to make sure that we can weed out those who are not, who are, for lack of a better term, making everybody else look bad, and causing really harmful concerns within our communities that are causing incredible amounts of pain and discomfort and fear. I think that most peace and police officers are amazing public servants, and they do want to do the right thing. So I think this will give us additional tools to make sure that we're rising the best to the top and eliminating those who should not be in the profession. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Any additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that we adopt the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. I have an A4 amendment related to arbitration reform. I will move the A4 amendment. Chair Mariani, would you like to discuss the amendment?
Mr. Chair, and I may need to dial a friend as well. I believe Representative Herr is sitting here as well, perhaps some other committee members. So basically what this amendment will do, we'll focus the reform on arbitration that we have in the bill to focus the new cohort, if you will, of arbitrators that can be selected for peace officer arbitration issues. To be real clear that we're focusing specifically on peace officers. So it's really important for us to make sure that we've got arbitrators that are knowledgeable in public safety, whose expertise is in working with peace officers. And then this matches the other reforms within the bill, which allow for a random selection of these arbitrators as opposed to the current system, which unfortunately creates a perverse outcome of making sure we always have, almost always have arbitrators that are just going to split everything down the middle. And nothing drives police chiefs more into a perplexed state than going carefully through the process of disciplining one of their peace officers, only to have that overturned by an arbitrator overturned by an arbitrator within an arbitration system where the goal is basically to half the time pick for the rank and file officer and half the time to pick for the police chief. So the idea here is to have objective decision-making based on facts on the ground. And the purpose of this amendment is to make sure that we have folks who are qualified, knowledgeable in terms of peace officer issues.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Representative Herr, did you want to add on anything to that?
No, Chair Mariani did a great job. Chair Freiberg, and I'm just for the interest of time, I'll be here to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is there any additional discussion to the A4 amendment? Seeing none, I will renew my motion to adopt the A4 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. So I believe that's the last amendment. So the bill is fully amended. Representative Gomez, it was suggested that you might want to explain your provision, since it is germane to GovOps, is that something you're able to do at this point?
I'm happy to. How much time do you want me to, what do you want me to say? Do you want me to just kind of like
just
talk about the concept of why it's in there, I guess?
Yeah, just briefly explain it. I mean, it's probably good to have some discussion on the record since that is germane to GovOps.
Sounds good. Thank you. So this provision establishes civilian oversight councils. I'll be offering an amendment that changes it somewhat. Right now, it is written to require all law enforcement agencies in the state to implement these councils. I'll be amending it to make these oversight bodies compulsory for any department that has more than 50 sworn officers and optional for other departments that are smaller. Some members kind of brought concern to me about the logistics of that since we have a lot of really small departments across our state. So if the post board statistics tell us that there's like over, I think it's more than 300 departments, in the state, and setting that threshold at 50 would include about 40 of them, but it also would cover a lot of the people in the state. So I represent District 62B. I represent the area at 38th and Chicago, where George Floyd was murdered by Minneapolis Police Department officers. think like many around of us and many people around the country and the world watched as Mr. Floyd, who was a member of our community and a beloved father and son and uncle and brother, begged for his life while public employees who are empowered by the state to use force against citizens acted with, you know, I think we were all, it was chilling to see the kind of disregard for the humanity of Mr. Floyd as he begged for his life, said he couldn't breathe, called out for his mother. And so there is, we're hearing very clearly from our community that they want accountability for officers who engage in misconduct. And there have been a lot of attempts over the years to establish civilian oversight of police because they're in a unique position. Again, as the chair pointed out, Chair Mariani pointed out to us. And so, you know, for example, in Minneapolis right now, we have the sort of two-tiered or two kind of track system. We have a police conduct review commission that deals with specific complaints against officers. We have a police conduct oversight commission that deals with policy related to law enforcement in the city. And, you know, both of these are, I think the perception of the public is that they're broken. Since 2013, there have been more than 2,000 complaints filed with the police conduct review body. 1.7% of those resulted in, you know, termination, demotion, or even a brief suspension. So that's sort of a considered, it's a very low amount of kind of punishment to be implemented in this kind of case. Another 1% received a letter of reprimand in their file. But, you know, we're hearing very explicitly from community that there's a desire for more oversight, because what they see, right, is that there's, since 2003, Minneapolis has paid out more than $45 million in settlements associated with police misconduct or brutality, and then at the same time seeing this very low level of discipline implemented is a real kind of really out of step for folks in our community who are asking for more accountability. You know, this is about Shalvin, who had 18 prior complaints against him. Maybe two of them, I think, were sustained. But, you know, this individual, and he worked for the Third Precinct, which was described recently in the Star Tribune as a, quote, playground for renegade cops. And people in the neighborhood know this officer because he's been involved in a number of use of force uses. He's been involved in a number of shootings. And, you know, I mentioned in the last hearing, like growing up in the neighborhood, it's there. We're sort of close to two precincts, to the third and the fifth, or threes and fives, like they call them, and inside the department. And when you see, as a young person, like people, kids in my neighborhood were trained to like know that if you saw a cop car pull up and there was a three versus a five as the first digit on the car, that you would expect the cops to be rougher and kind of a little bit less courteous, and you had to watch out for those cops. And so that is kind of borne out in this analysis that was done by the newspaper recently. Also, like we do have internal affairs, and as I said, the Police Conduct Review Commission, but that body that deals with policy did a check on this process a few years ago. So you're supposed to be able to, as a citizen, each of us is supposed to be able to walk into a police precinct to say that we want to file a complaint, to be given an explanation of what the process is, to be able to fill out a form there and file the complaint, which then gets forwarded to the police conduct review body and internal affairs. When the PCOC, Police Conduct Oversight Commission, who deals with policy for the department, did an independent check, they sent 15 people out just like randomly to see if they could file these complaints. In 12 of 15 cases, they were not able to make the complaints. And so what we see is a system that's basically, you know, because of the power of the of internal affairs and because of the fact that the Police Conduct Review Commission does not have the ability to conduct an independent investigation, and they have to rely on the information that's provided to them by the department, whether it's through internal affairs or through, you know, just sort of through the regular administration. So we truly have a system where police regulate themselves, in a manner of speaking, and it's not working for our communities. And so the intent here is to, you know, kind of beef up the, especially the investigative authority of these bodies, so that they're able to really help identify those cases where there are incidents or individuals that are imperiling the public trust, because that's really like what is necessary for a functioning law enforcement agency, is that folks in the community feel comfortable calling them in times of crisis. And I'm happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. I do have Representative Quam on the list to speak. So Ranking Member Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Gomez, I like the idea of the future amendment. You know, for small communities that have very small departments, you know, some flexibility in there. I was hoping that you would include in here that members of these boards or entities would have to do a walk along in each of the precincts, you know, across the year, so that they would actually be walking in the community with police officers as they interact with, you know, the businesses and the residents and et cetera, to get a better understanding, as opposed to waiting till something happens and then looking at some of the information and data that would help them be more familiar with the neighborhoods. So if there are multiple precincts, they'd have to, within a year, you know, participate in this across. I mean, those type of different activities that I think would have them in touch with both the community and the diversity of the community and the law enforcement. I was wondering if that was looked at and there's a future amendment that might be coming.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Quam. I didn't consider being that prescriptive. This is, you know, sort of designed to give, to empower local municipalities to constitute these councils in a way that makes sense for their community. I definitely like agree with you that, you know, I certainly have done ride-alongs in my own precinct, found it really eye-opening and helpful in sort of understanding the scope of what officers deal with. I went on a, like, what do they call it? They call it like dog watch, I think, or I don't know. Like I did the overnight shift. Again, found it really enlightening. And I think that that recommendation might make sense, but I'm sort of leaving it up to you know, cities and counties and towns to decide what the sort of requirements in terms of training and acquainting members of the public who want to serve in this capacity are.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the intent of this conversation was maybe not making it prescriptive, but having in there the suggestion that they have all the people that are appointed have opportunity to interact in non-crisis situations. In other words, they should be having interactions with the community and with law enforcement before there's an issue, and the local municipality to be able to come up with appropriate measures. I just want this bill to be better at bringing people together, and by having people interact outside of the stress situation, I think is good. And I offer to have a conversation with Representative Gomez and others, sort of out of the box ways of changing it, because this has been an issue for many decades. So I like the intent that we're going on. I just think we need to have a more global view and offer more as options, so that different situations and communities could be able to implement what would work best for them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. I'm sure Representative Gomez would be happy to work with you offline. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a comment about some of the things that St. Cloud has been doing. And I think what I'm looking at for a lot of these bills are ways that we do not upset the apple cart in St. Cloud. I'm very proud of the work that our police department has done and the partnership that it has with the city of St. Cloud. Several years ago, one of the officers that came to St. Cloud from Racine, Wisconsin, had seen a concept, and it's called Cop House, Community Outpost. And what it is, what we did in St. Cloud is we took a house that was known for a lot of bad activity, and they actually tore the house down. They bought the property, tore the house down, and built a new home there. And what they use it for is a community gathering space, an information space. They have classes there. The kids come all the time. It is just a wonderful, active area now for the police officers to interact with the community so they get to know each other. And it's just been booming, just absolutely going gangbusters. And it's, and I really invite anybody to come and we'll set up a tour and you'll get to see what happens there. It's just really quite amazing. It is right across from the Boys and Girls Club by the St. Cloud State Campus. It's just been going great. But another thing that we do is we also, when it comes to the mental health realm, that we recently started a CAT team, Community Action Team. And what it does is it involves some critical folks in our community, like the human services person at Stearns County, Central Minnesota Mental Health Center. It's the police department. It's really anybody who is really critical when a call it comes in, especially for mental health. Right now, we have a mental health professional that goes with on those calls. So it's not just the officers who need to have additional training. We're actually bringing folks in who regularly, they are Minnesota mental health professionals. And it has made a huge difference in the calls that we have been seeing. So what I would suggest is that maybe if anybody's interested to come down and do a tour of what our, or see what our police department has been doing. I am so proud of the wonderful work that they have been doing, and they are groundbreaking in many areas. I know Congressman Emmer now has a bill that would address cop houses for every state, and I think it's something that would really work in these communities. Get the cops right in the middle of it. They have emergency personnel, our first responders that hang out there. It's just really been working great. So I like a lot of about what we're talking about, but I also at the same time am feeling very protective, and I hope it doesn't mess up what we already have in our community. But please let me know if anybody's interested in coming to St. Cloud and seeing what we're doing here. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice. I appreciate the offer. I don't have anybody left on the list to discuss this. We do have about 5 minutes remaining before we have to stop. Maybe just wait a few seconds to see if anybody else would like to speak. And then I would turn it over to Chair Mariani for any closing words. Okay, I don't see anybody having raised their hands. So Chair Mariani, any closing remarks?
Mr. Chair, members, I appreciate the careful thought that everyone has brought to this debate. I took 4 pages of notes. I think it's critically important that we band together and work to pass the strongest set of proposals that we can this year. It's going to involve doing the combination of things that and enhancing the things that, for instance, Representative Tice talked about, but not stopping there, because that simply is not going to be enough. We also have to do this deep system shifting and accountability work as well. So I look forward to ongoing conversation with my colleagues here, and I appreciate your support today.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 75, as amended, be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Salk.
Yes.
Representative Kwan.
Yes.
Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Gomez.
Aye.
Representative Heinrich.
No.
Representative Cagle.
Yes.
Representative Lehman. Representative Lehman. Representative Lee.
Aye.
Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Tice.
Yes.
Representative Vogel.
No.
Representative West.
Aye.
Representative Lehman.
Aye.
With 14 ayes and 3 nays, motion passes.
Okay. The motion passes. The bill as amended is referred to the Ways and Means Committee. So thank you, Chair Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
So that concludes our agenda. Members, please keep an eye on your emails. It's looking likely that we will be having a hearing tomorrow as well. Maybe in the 4:30 range, I think I heard, but and the agenda will be out very soon. Is there any questions or—
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nash.
Regarding that, is there a bill that's going to be coming forward? And because amendment deadlines would be an appropriate conversation relative to that.
Yes, there likely will be. We're waiting to get that, and as I did for this hearing, I will try to make sure there's at least 24-hour, or you know, there's opportunity to provide amendments. So I may push. I may end up pushing the amendment deadline till tomorrow, just because of that. That's a fair question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kwan. If you're speaking, you're muted.
I had manually unmuted, and then somebody unmuted it for me, which muted me again. What I wanted to say is these bills are not, I think, quite mature. We're seeing them early in the special session, and I hope they improve. And I voted for the last bill with the intent and hope that it does improve. But I'm glad to see we're having the discussion and moving it along. And I look forward to future discussions. But anytime you can give us a little more time to review the documents and the amendments would be great. Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's understandable. I mean, it's a little hectic because we are in special session, and the timing is very moving very rapidly, more so than usual, but I will certainly do my best to give you as much notice as possible. I believe we are going to be cut off if we haven't been already, because we're required to be done at 9:30. So there's nobody else who's agreed to speak. So with that, I will adjourn the meeting.